The Guardian.
Science Weekly is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace's award-winning templates are the most beautiful way to present your ideas online. See for yourself. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code GUARDIANSCIENCE to get 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. Squarespace. Make your next move. Make your next website.
There's no point in acting surprised about it.
In Douglas Adams's Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the book's human protagonists are taunted by the galaxy's alien overlords for their provincial approach to space travel.
What do you mean you've never been to Alpha Centauri? Oh, for heaven's sake, mankind, it's only 4 light-years away, you know?
To most of us, this is funny because 4 light-years is obviously an unbridgeable distance.
Energise the demolition beams.
But to the Russian entrepreneur and physicist Yuri Milner, perhaps it read more like a challenge.
Well, I think it's the next frontier. This is something that people have been dreaming and thinking about for thousands of years.
On April the 12th last year, Milner announced a new and ambitious initiative called Breakthrough Starshot.
But only in the last 15 years, it became practically possible to talk about this project.
Kickstarted with $100 million, the initiative aims to develop and demonstrate an unmanned space probe capable of travelling at 20% of the speed of light. This would lay the foundations for a mission to Alpha Centauri, our closest star system, that might arrive within Milner's own lifetime.
She's available, and it's mostly an engineering challenge and not a scientific challenge.
But how are scientists proposing to achieve such mind-blowing speeds? What are some of the main challenges for the technology? And if we manage to send a probe 4 light-years away and send a picture back, what might we see?
We have this thing in science we call the giggle factor. So when you tell someone what you're working on, they can laugh at it because it's just so silly, right? So believe it or not, even 20 years ago, if you were to talk to me and I say, well, I'm working on exoplanets, people would literally just laugh.
And so I do think that we are very often limited by boundaries, by limitations that we impose on ourselves rather than the reality of the situation.
I'm Hannah Devlin. This is Science Weekly.
Hello.
Hi, Avi. It's Hannah here at The Guardian. To give us some background on Breakthrough Starshot, I spoke to someone who's right at the heart of the initiative.
Sure. This seems to be a very common question.
This is Avi Loeb.
My name is Avi Loeb. I'm the Frank B. Bird, the professor of science at Harvard University, chair of the astronomy department at Harvard, and the director of 2 centers at Harvard. One is the Institute for Theory and Computation, and the second is the Black Hole Initiative.
Avi also chairs the advisory board for the Breakthrough Starshot Initiative, and I spoke with him via Skype this week.
When I go out at night to my backyard and I look at the sky, I see all these stars. I often wonder whether, you know, they look like lights in a giant spaceship sailing through space. And I often wonder if there are passengers near the other lights over there. And in particular, is there life like we find on Earth? That's a very fundamental question, perhaps the one for which, if we find an answer, our conception of our place in the universe and the way we behave will change. In addressing that, we can stare at those stars from a distance, but we could also, in principle, visit them. We can go there. And most people give up on that hope just by realizing that the distances are vast. Thanks to Yuri Milner and discussions we had with him, we converged on a plan that could allow us potentially to visit the nearest stars within our lifetime. So Yuri came to my office at Harvard about a couple of years ago and asked me whether I'm willing to contemplate the possibility of traveling to the nearest star, to Proxima or to Alpha Centauri, the other 2 stars, because he would like to take photographs of a possible habitable planet there and see if there is life. And that will open the door to visit other stars in the future.
What was your first reaction when he asked you that question? Was it, that's madness, or was it, it might be realistic?
So even though I'm a theoretical astrophysicist, I'm down to earth in a way. I'm practical. So this is not a philosophical question. This is a technological question and a physics question. Can we imagine a technology that would allow us to do that? And by that I mean a technology that does not violate the laws of physics, that doesn't have a fatal challenge that would not allow it to be realized in the near future. Of course, there are dreams. I mean, people, for example, talked for many years about the propulsion using nuclear fusion, nuclear fission, but that's not practical at the moment. We don't have a fusion reactor that is providing more energy than it gets, and not to speak about the weight of such a thing, even if we had it. So, and people talked about engines based on matter and antimatter, annihilating, all kinds of schemes that do not seem to be practical in the next few decades. So that these were off the table. We did listen to various presentations by people that suggest new technologies. But the bottom line was that the best way to do it, and there is one way to do it, and that one is not to carry the fuel with the spacecraft, because otherwise one suffers from the so-called rocket equation, the tyranny of the rocket equation. If you carry the fuel, then it turns out that you can't move much faster than the exhaust speed. And the exhaust speed, the speed by which gas flows out of the exhaust, is typically limited to about 10 to the minus 4, a percent of the speed of light. And if you want to reach the fifth of the speed of light, you can't do it with a rocket approach. And so not carrying the fuel is the key. And the idea is to use a beam of light that is pushing on a sail. And in principle, a beam of light propagates at the speed of light, so it can catch up with a spacecraft, even if the spacecraft approaches the speed of light. And so one can imagine pushing on a sail, just like a sailboat is being pushed by wind. The light, as it bounces off the sail, gives it momentum, just like the wind does as the particles of air bounce off a sail, they give it momentum. The same way the particles of light give momentum to the light sail.
And so it will be light and not fuel that accelerates the probe. Before we get into more detail about the approach and its many technological challenges, I wanted to know a bit more about what we might find on a visit to Alpha Centauri.
I see. Are you interviewing other people for this episode?
Yes. This is Sarah Seeger.
Professor Sarah Seeger, astrophysicist and planetary scientist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
I spoke with Sarah via Skype this week and started by asking her about Proxima Centauri, the closest of the three stars within the Alpha Centauri system. And what do we know so far about Proxima Centauri and the connected exoplanet Proxima b, just from the observations we've made from Earth and from space telescopes?
Well, about Proxima Centauri b, the planet, we know that it's there. We know something about its orbit, and we know its approximate mass. But beyond that, we actually don't know a whole lot. But nevertheless, we're thrilled that there is a planet around the nearest star, and that it has a chance to actually be, a good chance to be, a rocky world in the so-called habitable zone of its host star.
Could you tell me a bit about the host star? How does it compare to the Sun?
Okay, so in exoplanets, people like myself, I really want to know what's out there. And I am actually myself obsessed and focused on the true Earth twin. That's an Earth-sized planet in an Earth-like orbit, a one-year orbit about a Sun-like star, and a planet with oceans and continents, and just like a very nice place to live and breathe and just exist. But in exoplanets, we can't find those types of planets right now. So we have instead what we call a race to the bottom, where the bottom means the smallest stars out there, because it turns out that it's so much easier to find planets with all the tools we have today around small stars. And so Proxima Centauri, a red dwarf star, the nearest star to our sun, has been a natural target for a very long time for people to study. And you know what happened was, in a few years ago, people had been monitoring this star, and it looked like there might be a planet around, but the data was really bad, and it wasn't obvious. And so another group did a campaign, and they actually looked at this star for some number of months, like a few months, and lo and behold, the signal improved so much that they were able to robustly claim that there is a planet around Proxima Centauri. And not only just any planet, but actually it's a planet that could be about the mass of Earth and in a favorable orbit, so that as heated by the star, the planet actually might be the right temperature to support life. But Proxima Centauri itself, even though it's our very, very, very nearest star, it is still 4 light years away. So it is still trillions and trillions of miles, like 20 trillion miles away, which is such a vast distance. It's almost incomprehensible, yet it's still our nearest star.
And what do we know about what it might be like standing on the planet? You've mentioned that it's rocky and it might have about the right temperature to support life. Are there other similarities and differences?
So in exoplanets, when we find a planet, sometimes we know very little about it. And in particular, the method that astronomers have used to find Proxima Centauri b, we only actually know the minimum mass. So this method involves measuring the minimum mass. So it could be much more massive. There's some chance it could be too massive to be a planet anything nearly like Earth. So that's why I'm hesitating. I can't give you like the exact, here it is, it's like this, it's like that. But of course, we do love to speculate. And one thing about the planets in the habitable zones of red dwarf stars is they're quite close to the star. That is because as heated by the star gives out very low energy compared to our sun. And so for the planet to be the right temperature, it has to be much closer to its star than our Earth is to the sun. And being close to the star, the planet and star have tidal interactions. And these tidal interactions actually can slow down the rotation rate, or like the day of the planet. And just like our moon and Earth have tidal interaction, right? Because we can go to the ocean and see tides on a daily basis. And those tides actually have affected our moon in slowing our moon's rotation down until, amazingly enough, the moon has the same rotation rate as its revolution around Earth. That means a day equals a year for an exoplanet. And we believe that these exoplanets are tidally locked. That is, they show the same face to the star at all times. So if we were able to get in a spacecraft and voyage to Proxima Centauri b and land on the surface, assuming it's a rocky world with an atmosphere we can breathe in, it would be phenomenal for us because we would see the star in the sky, and it would be a bigger star than our Earth looks, because Proxima Centauri b is closer to its star than the Earth is to the sun. But not only that, because of this tidal locking, that star, the sun on Proxima Centauri b, would actually appear to be in the same place in the sky at all times.
Proxima Centauri might be our closest star, but it's still around 4 light years away, or 24 trillion miles. So with the fastest rockets available today, you're looking at a journey time of around 137,000 years.
Just take me through what the technology is.
And that's where Breakthrough Starshot comes in. Avi Loeb again.
So the concept is to have a sail that weighs roughly a gram, has a size and area of roughly 4 meters by 4 meters, so altogether 16 meters squared, on which a laser beam is focused. The laser has a wavelength of roughly 1 micron, so it's in the infrared. It can go through the atmosphere. So the beamer that produces the laser beam is on the surface of the Earth, at a site where the atmosphere will be quiet and transparent, and then the beam of the laser is focused on the sail, which is released above the atmosphere. Now the sail is attached to electronics, which weighs roughly a gram, and so you can in principle pack a camera, navigation device, and communication. And all kinds of other probes, you can pack them within a weight of roughly a gram. And that technology is already here. That is not as much of a challenge because we already have it in cell phones and so forth. And then this electronics will be connected to the sail, perhaps etched on it or connected, held by to it, and then the sail will be released above the atmosphere from a mother spacecraft that could release once a day a sail. So these sails will not be very expensive. They will be at the level of hundreds of dollars. There will be many of them that will be pushed by the same beamer. And so the idea is that as soon as the sail is released, the beam of radiation is focused on it, and then it pushes it for a couple of minutes. If the beam power is about 50 gigawatt, over 2 minutes, it can propel a gram scale spacecraft near the speed of light.
Avi compares the technology to a sailing boat. But instead of being propelled by air molecules in the wind, the probe will be driven forward by photons of light from powerful laser beams here on Earth. Now, the nearest star... Clearly, there are some major challenges to overcome before any of this could actually happen. But if the technology could be made to work, how long might it take to get to Alpha Centauri? Yes.
So it takes about 2 minutes to launch the sail to a fifth of the speed of light over a distance of 2 million kilometers, and then 20 years to reach Alpha Centauri. So it's a very long journey during which not much is happening along the way. And then once we get to the Alpha Centauri system, we potentially would like to visit a habitable planet there. As it turns out, after we announced the project, a few months later, a discovery of a habitable planet near Proxima was announced. And that is called the Proxima B, the planet that was found. So it could potentially have an atmosphere and have liquid water, ocean on its surface. And we would like to find out by sending a probe that flies close to it, taking a photograph of this planet and seeing whether it's blue, meaning having oceans on it, whether it's yellow, having desert, whether it's green, having vegetation. And so a flyby, just like New Horizons flew near Pluto, you know, would be very informative. We would like to get these photographs. By the way, on the same technology, in principle, could be used also to explore the solar system, obviously. It would take only a half a week to reach Pluto with at a fifth of the speed of light. When New Horizons was launched, the NASA administrator was different than when it arrived a decade later to Pluto. Here we are talking about arriving the same week to Pluto. So potentially it shortens the distance to all targets that one might find appealing. But the way I see it is that it's an important milestone. If we will be able to reach the nearest star, that will open a new window into the cosmos for us, because then we can contemplate sending more massive spacecrafts out there and potentially extending the reach of our civilization. There is no reason for us to stay confined to the solar system. We might, you know, the conditions will not be habitable once the sun dies within 7 billion years. But long before that, we might destroy our planet. And so I think it's very important to think big and to think about going much farther than Mars, going beyond the solar system. And this would be a major milestone for our civilization.
Avi and the whole Breakthrough Starshot team are certainly thinking big. But as you might have guessed, the project comes with some major challenges, some of which we'll hear about after this short break.
So you have many small lasers, each of which is a megawatt or 100 kilowatt. And if it's a megawatt, then you need 50,000 of them, side to side, packed across a field of roughly a kilometer in size.
We'll also hear why wildly ambitious projects like Breakthrough Starshot have an important role in science.
So it's possible that through this research and the funding for it and the bringing things together, that something different might emerge later on.
We'll be right back.
Great.
create a beautiful website with Squarespace's all-in-one platform. There's nothing to install, patch, or upgrade, ever. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code GuardianScience to get 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace. Make your next move. Make your next website.
Before we kick off again, I wanted to point you in the direction of another podcast here at The Guardian. Presented by Claire Armitstead, Richard Lee and Sean Kane, The Guardian's Books podcast is a weekly look at the world of books, poetry and great writing, which features in-depth interviews with leading authors and investigations into the thematic trends in contemporary writing. Recent episodes include an interview with Pakistani author Mohsin Hamid, a look at the long list for this year's Man Booker International Prize, and a chat with the short story master George Saunders. To subscribe to the Guardian Books podcast, head to theguardian.com/podcasts or get it on your favourite podcast app. Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Hannah Devlin. Before the break, Professor Sarah Seeger talked to us about Alpha Centauri and how one of its exoplanets, Proxima B, might offer the perfect conditions for life. We also heard from Professor Avi Loeb on the Breakthrough Starshot initiative, which aims to get there using unmanned spacecraft travelling at around 20% of the speed of light. That's 13 billion miles per hour. And as Avi explained before the break, the approach they're focusing on involves a fleet of tiny space sails propelled by lasers.
It seems incredible that you could have a laser on Earth beaming up to something that's just a few metres across and hitting it precisely enough to send it exactly in the right direction. And while it's going at a tremendous speed, that must be a massive challenge in the concept.
It is a technological challenge, but it doesn't violate any of the laws of physics, and it's in principle a challenge that can be met based on our projection. To focus the beam of light, what you need is an array of smaller scale lasers. So you have many small lasers, each of which is a megawatt or 100 kilowatt. And if it's a megawatt, then you need the 50,000 of them side to side, packed across a field of roughly a kilometer in size. So you have an array of lasers, each of which is producing a beam of its own, and then the beams are combined coherently into a single very powerful beam of 50 gigawatt. And then the issue is that it needs to go through the atmosphere, and the atmosphere has turbulence in it. And so one needs to correct for the blurring of the spot of the laser beam in the atmosphere as it passes through the atmosphere. And there are ways to do that, to have active control of the phase of the laser beam, making sure that the beam is focused on the sail as it moves. It's a big challenge, but potentially it's doable.
These lasers are incredibly powerful. If you were stood in front of that laser beam, presumably you'd just be eviscerated immediately. But you need this really delicate, light sail to withstand that and be powered forward by it. What kind of materials can do that?
That's right. We actually, before the public announcement, we identified 20 challenges, and then defining those challenges as the focus areas where, you know, the technology development will need to focus so that we can make progress. And so aside from the laser, being able to combine many small laser beams into a single coherent beam, the next important issue is the sail. And In the case of the sail, we want it to be made of material that is lightweight, that weighs only a gram, but nevertheless is sturdy and strong enough to withstand the illumination by the laser beam. And the first issue is that it needs to reflect the laser beam very effectively without absorbing any of it. If only one part in 100,000 of the laser power is being absorbed by the surface of this sail, it will burn up. It's very similar to the story of Icarus. If you build wings out of wax and you pass close to the sun and you absorb that light, you lose your wings. And so we need materials that are perfect reflectors. And there are designs of lightweight materials that can, in principle, absorb very little of the light. Already people are working on such materials in the laboratory now. And so potentially, one can imagine constructing a sail that would be sturdy and could reflect and not absorb any of the light. For example, materials like graphene or metamaterials that are being discussed, where even a very thin layer that is a few atoms thick could potentially reflect very effectively light that is shining on it.
And it's not just the material of these sails that presents the challenge.
I should mention also that there is the issue of the sail riding in a stable fashion on the beam. If you imagine a parachute-shaped sail, a sail that looks like an umbrella that is riding on a beam, it turns out that that is not stable. We wrote a paper about it with a postdoc of mine, Zach Manchester, where we showed that this design would be unstable, so the sail will basically be pushed out of the beam very quickly. And so it turns out that a more stable configuration is to make a spherical sail, a sail that looks like a large ping-pong ball, and then put it in a hollow beam, a beam that has less power in the middle of it, and then it will be trapped inside the beam.
The idea of sending a fleet of giant ping-pong balls across the galaxy to a distant star might sound like madness. It's fair to say that almost every aspect of the mission lies right at the brink of what might be technologically feasible. In fact, the Breakthrough Initiative itself outlines 20 challenges that it will need to take on before the mission could be possible.
So this kind of technology would allow you to get somewhere really quickly, but at the same time, you're going to be...
Crucially though, the team argue that all of these challenges can be overcome without violating the laws of physics, which Avi says means none of them are showstoppers. Within this list is the huge challenge of trying to send a picture back from a probe that's 4 light-years away.
Yes, so one of the challenges is communication. Taking the picture is no problem. As I mentioned, the technology for equipping the spacecraft with necessary camera, the issue is really whether we can detect the signal from that spacecraft, given that it's so far away, 4 light-years away. In that regard, we still have to do some work, but potentially one needs a receiver that is as big as the beamer. You need roughly a kilometer squared receiver that will receive the signal from the spacecraft. The spacecraft can easily direct the beam of communication to the direction of the Earth, because the Earth is roughly where the Sun is. So you don't need to aim it very precisely, but it will be very weak when it gets to the Earth, because we can only put transmitter that is roughly a watt or so in power on that spacecraft. And so the challenge is to detect the signal. But the preliminary calculations that we have done indicate that although it's challenging, we can imagine having a receiver that is sufficiently sensitive. And actually, right now, we are working on a paper with Zach Manchester that will quantify what needs to be done to detect the signal.
So many things would need to fall in place for the Breakthrough Starshot Initiative to achieve its ultimate goal. That said, even if the project fails to get to Alpha Centauri, the attempt to do so may still prove worthwhile.
Probe or hundreds of probes that are going to be sent out. Do you think that...
Sarah Seeger again.
I mean, it's definitely a very extremely ambitious project. And sometimes when you start on a giant, very innovative path, you end up taking a right turn or a left-hand turn. You end up doing something actually different than you set out to do. So it's possible that through this research and the funding for it and the bringing things together, that something different might emerge later on. I don't know how it's going to go.
So you mean, say, even if these probes only got 10 times as far as, you know, Voyager is today, rather than 2,000 times as far, that might still tell us something amazing?
Well, I meant a couple things. One is I meant that they may discover new technology or a new way of putting things together, you know, and eventually change their actual way of doing it. Or as you say, they might find a way to travel, even if they can launch these things, and even if initially they don't make it that far, imagine getting to Mars in 4 days instead of 6 months, or getting into Pluto pretty quickly. I mean, it could still change the way that we move through space. But I do think the idea, it's a great idea to try out and to try to push forward.
Are the community as a whole, do they tend to get in the spirit of things and be enthusiastic about this sort of a very ambitious approach?
Well, I'd say yes and no. So we have this thing in science we call the giggle factor. So when you tell someone what you're working on, they can laugh at it because it's just so silly, right? So believe it or not, even 20 years ago, if you were to talk to me and I say, well, I'm working on exoplanets, people would literally just laugh. And they would think that's just like so silly. Like, why would you do it? But as we move forward with finding all these planets and now the planet orbiting Proxima Centauri, it just becomes less funny. So fewer and fewer people will laugh at it now and go, that's just so silly, because this kind of giggle factor keeps shifting. But if you want to know the other side of the story, is that if someone offers $100 million to fund an area of research, people take it seriously. And they're not necessarily buying into that the whole concept will magically work within the 20-year time frame they'd like to see it work in. But each individual can move his or her own research forward.
And this is a sentiment echoed by Avi Loeb.
And so as long as the team of people is of high quality and the work that is being done is of high quality and is reliable, it will gain momentum. And I think it will change the perception. Frankly, I don't care what other people think. If there is a challenge that seems feasible, I'm excited about pursuing it. And I think the perception of people will change with time, and that is not a non-issue. If you look at the history of science, the history of technology, almost every important discovery was preceded by disbelief to start with. It's unfortunate because we were wrong so many times. You know, we thought that the Earth is at the center of the universe. We thought, and the sun moves around it. We thought that heavy things fall faster than light things. All of these things, you know, that turned out to be wrong just because someone dared to check it, to test it, to imagine things beyond what other people are willing to imagine. And so I do think that we are very often limited by boundaries, by limitations that we impose on ourselves rather than the reality of the situation. We did check that there are no showstoppers. You know, that's very important for any ambitious project. And now the next step is to try and demonstrate the technology. If we end up finding that it doesn't work, we will move on to something else. But we should definitely give it a try and not be shy from this amazing opportunity to broaden the horizons of our civilization.
Special thanks this week to Avi Loeb and Sarah Seeger. We'll include a link to the official webpage of the Breakthrough Starshot Initiative in the episode's description on the Guardian website, which includes the list of 20 challenges mentioned by Avi. I'm Hannah Devlin. This is Science Weekly.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.